Welcome to Mysterious Universe Plus, Season 22, Episode 19. Coming up on this show, we've got the dripping DMT proboscis, the soul constructors, and being propositioned by Pan. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Again, does the opener and the ending one there, are they connected in some way?
Oh, yeah, I can see how you would think that, yeah. The dripping proboscis. Mm.
And no, Pan, nature?
No, they're different stories.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good news.
But in your mind, if you want them to be the same thing. You can keep thinking about it.
Look, I've just spent a day reading about sperm being hijacked by spirit guardians. It's been a full-on day, okay? So you can understand why it's a little bit filthy.
Your stuff sounds amazing. You've got a Guy Lyon Playfair book on your desk there. Tell us what you've been cooking up.
Yeah, so he's really fascinating. I mean, we've discussed some of his work in the past, so I thought I'd go and pick up some of his earlier works. And I picked up The Indefinite Boundary, and this is essentially him looking into the concept of life after death. And I thought the whole thing was going to be about reincarnation, and that plays a really big part in this story. But the book is more about just the actual spirit world in itself and how the nature of the spirit world is so unusual that it collides with so many aspects of our reality that we just don't understand. So I wanted to go into some of those crazy stories. And yes, there are apparently these beings that came, they were channeled or they were viewed through a group of Brazilian spiritualists who understood that these beings essentially construct your body before you go into it. And they miniaturize it and then they shove it into the ovum.
So are they devas or some kind of spirits that construct the physical body? Because we've looked at that before. There's the idea that people on psychedelics and having kind of third eye insight have seen that it's the idea of the morphic field of the body, like the energetic structure of the body needs to be created before the physical cells start to replicate and the human fetus is built.
I think you're right, except it's a little bit more graphic than that. And it also gives you some insight as to why people suffer from, you know, unfortunate disabilities. Yeah, there's a reason for it. And it comes back to that idea of it's karma. And you basically will make a decision to come into this life. And when you come into this life, you already know what your body is going to be like. And they can even put these ticking time bombs in you. So all of a sudden you can develop a problem at a certain age and you go, where did that come from? And you have no family history of it. And all of a sudden you get something. And according to these spiritualists, it's all been preordained. It's all been set up and ready for you to go. In fact, you know, I might just jump into it in a moment, but what have you got coming up?
Oh, I went back into the fairy census from Simon Young.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted to look at some of the stories I had missed from Scotland, Ireland, Wales, Canada, and North America.
Yep.
And it also reminded me to ask people to stop telling me about their gay little bells on their Harleys. Because on the last Plus episode, I made fun of the idea of having bells on a motorcycle.
Doesn't and make then, it gay. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, but I'm not saying it's gay, but the little bells are gay. Because they're tiny little bells. They go ding, 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 ding. And many, many people who ride motorcycles, specifically Harleys, messaged me, tweeted at me, emailed in and said, no, these bells exist. And every time, apart from the first time, every time I replied to them, yes, I know now. But I know that the gay little bells exist.
What amazed me about that, though, was the fact that out of that entire book, that's the only piece of information that actually was real. And that's why, by that point, I think you gave up.
Yeah, I started to just assume that everything she was writing about was nonsense. So when she started writing about bells on a motorcycle, I thought, oh, this is obviously equivalent to the pigeon fairy. And decided not to look it up. But no, it's true. I don't really think we have that here in Australia, the little bells on motorcycles.
No,
but
I don't think it's something that's reached into, although I'm not really sure.
I haven't seen it, but I don't ride those kind of bikes because it's more the kind of cruiser style, Harley Davidson style, where they'll put those little bells on their bikes. And some people sent some images.
And it's kind of massive, like manly, scary bikes.
I still find it hilarious because these little bells, they're tiny little things, right? And the idea is you're supposed to have them on the lowest point of the motorcycle. But if you look at the bells you can buy, because some people sent some links to me, they've got skulls on them and knives and flames. And then I thought, you know, the whole kind of, what's the word? The whole imagery surrounding that culture is death and demons. Like the whole imagery of that badass biker is like a flaming skull.
Yeah.
It's basically it's luring death. It's toying with death and evil. And that's the whole culture. And then you've got this little bell. You've got this little ding. This little bell's meant to ward it all off.
It's kind of like,
I still find it bizarre and hilarious.
I guess it's like superstitions, though. It's like, you may not even believe in it, but you don't want to take the risk. Like, you're more than happy to indulge in the culture completely, but you're like,
you've got a giant demon on the back of your leather jacket, and you think this little bell's going to make a difference.
Yeah, that's will completely save you.
Thank you, everyone, every 437 Harley riders who are on Plus. Thank you for emailing in, but I understand now that I got it wrong. The bell thing is real.
My favorite is when people send you pictures of the pigeon. I'm like, is this the pigeon?
Maybe the pigeon's out there.
the pigeon's not out there, I promise you.
So I'm going to go back into the census and just catch a couple of stories that we missed. But ultimately, it leads me into the hairy, dripping proboscis, because there's this interesting kind of crossover where you start to look at the respondents to that fairy census and mm-hmm. you start to see the patterns of them describing the mental state they're in when they see these weird things. And often they're saying, my mind was open, or I was in some kind of altered state of consciousness. I ended up going to the excellent website of, what's his name again? Neil Rushton, deadbutdreaming.wordpress.com. Oh, yeah. He's got this great blog all about fairies.
Yeah.
But he's got a bunch of really fantastic articles diving into these crossovers with altered states of consciousness that ultimately naturally goes into the DMT area.
Yeah.
So we're going to have some pretty wild DMT experiences as well.
Oh, well then let's just jump quickly into this story. It's only a short story, but I wanted to mention it because it really highlights just some of the weirdness of the concept of karma. And I guess karma is kind of a term that's thrown out there where people are like, oh, that's bad karma, or you're going to get karma for that. But in some spiritualist traditions, and obviously in Buddhism and Eastern culture traditions as well, it's something that's very solid. Like in another dimension, it's a very solid material and it can affect your spiritual body in ways you can't even begin to comprehend. But essentially the reason why, and this book, you know, by Guy Leon Playfair kind of addresses this, is that why, you know, suicide rates in Buddhist cultures, for example, are really, really low. And the reason why they're really low is because there seems to be this pervasive understanding that death doesn't allow you to escape from your problems.
Yeah.
Because if you kill yourself, you actually potentially can contribute more karma to yourself because you've taken a life.
Didn't we discuss this recently, that suicide is essentially viewed as killing because you're a sentient being. So even if you're killing yourself, you're still killing a sentient being and you're ruining this path that's been set up for your life.
Yeah.
And you're just causing all this trouble, creates all this karma.
Exactly, exactly.
Doesn't matter if it's you.
Well, and also what is, you know, kind of highlighted and parallels with the beliefs that come from, you know, Brazilian spiritualists is that if you kill yourself and you have a particular problem, let's say that you're suffering from, you know, you get to a point where you lose your job and you become an alcoholic and you fall into this pit of despair and sadly you take your life, that actually magnifies in your next existence. Because it was actually something, according to these spiritualists, that was set up for you to overcome. And until you overcome it, it will keep on happening in every single existence until you get to a point where you've actually succeeded. You've taken over. You win the level, to put it into a gaming perspective. But if you commit suicide, what actually happens is that thing that you have to get over suddenly becomes greater and much bigger.
Oh, okay.
So it makes it even harder. And some people can get themselves, and you can see these people. I mean, you know, we all know these sorts of people that just get themselves into, you know, one disastrous situation after the next in their lives, because it's like there could be some karma playing a role here that they're not getting past. They're not trying to approach it in a different way.
It would make sense that it's harder because you've just killed someone, as in yourself.
In yourself,
and you've created more karma.
Yeah.
So you got to deal with more karma.
There was this one story I was reading today that was just an outlying case, and I was trying to find more details because Playfair highlights this concept of the bomb. And the bomb is like this biological organization mechanism or something, but essentially, again, in spiritualist terms and in some concepts, it's that when you, and people that have had near-death experiences describe this, when they leave their body, all of a sudden, like that Edgar Cayce kind of concept, you have access to all the information that's from all your previous lives as well. And essentially you form this entity, which is still you. Like it's still you of the body that's just passed or the consciousness that's just passed. But you are now a composite of every single life that you've led. So you kind of all of a sudden restore all this knowledge through all your lives. And there was this one case where a guy had found himself outside his body he was suffering from, it was typhus or some, you know, terrible illness in the 1800s. And when he was outside his body, he finds himself meeting with this entity, which is essentially him. It's like this floating purple, auric blue kind of form that's there. And as he sees this thing kind of floating like this blob, he instinctively knows that it's him, but it's him in all the concepts of him, in her and it and thing and everything he's ever been, including fog, like including water that comes up in some circumstances. Like there's some traditions that describe this idea that, I think it was the Jains. The Jains from India described that not only do you live, you know, a few hundred million lifetimes, you don't live it as a human being. You can be water. And apparently if you're water, you can go from being a lifetime of a few seconds to 7,000 years. You can also be fog.
So if you're a drop of water, you're just like, boop, boop, then you're dead. Just a little plop.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it. That's your lifespan.
Well, once you evaporate, like that's the end of it, right? That's, but if you're
but
an
if
ocean.
If you're part of the ocean, that's just, that'll never, oh my gosh, you got to wait for an asteroid to evaporate you.
And eventually it will. But yeah, you live these lives, of course, you live these millions of lives as everything. Every, you know, those four elements of air, water, earth,
that's,
fire.
That's the idea of why when you're in a human body, you want to cherish it and make the use of it because you don't know, you might come back as a rock or something that lasts for a really long time and you're just stuck there.
But that's also highlights why these entities and beings that mess with us, they want us because this is the pinnacle of existence in, I know that's like a speciesism or whatever, but like, whatever. We human beings are, according to spiritual practices, the pinnacle of you know, incarnation in this reality. Like that's what you've reached this point where you have complete sentience, you have, you know, knowledge of death, of the other world.
Well, I think the idea is when you're a human being, you have this connection to divinity that the lesser species don't have.
Right.
But they want it.
They want it. Exactly. And, you know, eventually though, if you look at this whole idea of karma, right, it's not about looking, I mean, I love animals. I'm not looking down on animals, but there's this idea that it's like animals then go through reincarnation as well. And they eventually get to this point.
Yeah, they're just not human beings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a process that you have to go through, which everyone can achieve. It's like this, you know, spiritual, you know, opportunism that everything has.
I think you were definitely a fog in your past life. That would explain why you can't remember shows we did 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, no recollection at all. Just none at all.
You're still in fog mode.
I probably am. But see, what was amazing about this is going back to that story of that guy that found himself outside his body. After he'd gotten sick, he'd done things where he'd had depression. Like he'd had depression and they thought for some reason, obviously the information isn't rapidly flowing. They thought that he'd killed himself. Like this him that was everything of him, it thought that he had killed himself and they were pissed off at him.
Oh.
And like that messed everything up and now we have to restart and we have to do it all over again. And he's like, no, I didn't kill myself. I've got scarlet fever or whatever he had. And then the being was like, oh, okay, all right. And then he ends up back in his body and he's actually recovers, fortunately, from that terrible illness. But he was able to bring this memory with him and this kind of, in a positive way, it broke him out of this depression. Because not only did he see the other side and realize that there was something else, he was also fearful that all the previous hymns were going to be pissed off because he upset the process. And so where this ties...
The process or the plan?
It's more of a process because the idea is that you're the one that has to make the choices. Like you're the one, like you follow through a process, but there's no real plan. I mean, there's a plan that you create. And what I mean by that is it will come apparent in these stories. But so what I'll do first is I'll describe this man. So there's a man by the name of Andre Luiz. You may have heard of him. He's popped up in, you know, multiple spiritual texts. He's been, you know, reviewed and looked into by many people, but Guy met him in Brazil when he basically was involved in, it was like an aid organization or a charity of some kind.
Yeah.
And so what happened was is that this charity organization, all of a sudden there was funding that was taken away. So he was stuck in Brazil and he had this great job that was going well and he was doing all this community work and it all kind of just disappeared. So he's like, well, what am I going to do? He ended up getting pulled into this spiritualist group. And when he goes to this spiritualist group, I mean, they were really out there. They were just a really incredible group. But as I said before, parallels with a whole heap of other spiritualist organizations all around the world. And they were doing multiple things like having seances and connecting with spirits but things that were a little bit more exotic, things that weren't really well known in the West. And when he started dealing with these people and talking to them, he met all these different people. And one of them, of course, was Andre. So when he met Andre, Andre describes to him how he has contact with this guide from the spirit world. And this guide is this Alexandre. So I don't know if it's kind of like a projection of his own spirit or if it's something, but it seems to be this external entity that kind of guides him through these spiritual visions. And he says that I realized that Alexandre could see the chromosomic dispositions in all masculine principles in motion.
The hell does that mean?
I know. When I read that, I was like, is that what I think it is? And yes, it is. Yes, it is. So this spirit guy, what he does is essentially a jizz guide. And what he will do... Well,
hang on. I'm pretty sure that's not what it means.
No, it is. It is. So listen to me. So what this spirit guide does is essentially he's involved in the administration of karma and reincarnation. So this guide can basically reform the chromatin inside a freshly fertilized egg and arrange it in a way that causes karmic, retribution.
So you're calling him a jizz guide.
So what he does, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but that's kind of a long, let me explain even further. So what he says is that when a body is supposed to be reincarnated, what these psi biologists is ultimately what they're referred to. These psi biologists perform this really incredible task. They create the body in this other realm before it turns, and when I say body, this is an adult body. It's not a baby body. So they create the adult body and they start molding it. And this is being shown to Andre as he's watching. And they create this body, this form. And it's kind of glowing, as you'd imagine being in this reality. And it kind of has different colors. It sounds almost curling in a way. And you can see like these little marks. And one of these guides is saying, oh, well, can you see where there are these dark spots here near the kidney and here near the spine or, you know, running down through the stomach? That's where he, at 42 or 47, he's going to develop a cancerous mass.
Oh, wow.
He's going to develop a stomach issue or something like that.
So not only is it kind of the energetic makeup of this, this individual as they, you know, age and progress in this physicality, it includes all the karmic points in their lifetime.
And the reason for that is, and the reason why I mentioned Jainism before is because with the idea of Jainism, it has to be about free choice. And so a really good example was, I think it was somewhere in southern India, the government wanted to get rid of stray dogs. And the Jains said, well, no, you can't. You can't poison them, because that was the plan, was to go and poison the dogs. And they had people that were working for the government that were Jains. And the Jains said, no, I conscientiously object. So the way that they got around it is that the Jains took two buckets. One was a bucket of poisoned meat and one was a bucket of fresh meat, and they threw both around. And that was because they believed that, well, the dog will be able to make free choice. So if the dog eats the poison one, that was karmically meant to happen. But if the dog eats the non-poison one, that was karmically meant to happen as well.
And all the dogs ate both of them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't necessarily, but that was kind of the, I guess, the religious way that they got around it. But extrapolate that to what's going on in this spiritual realm. So they create this body and they've created these points. And one of these spirit guides points to one of these marks and he says it's because the soul that's going to inhabit this body, it has chosen to come back in this body because in the previous lifetime, it stabbed and murdered somebody in these locations. So these locations where he had it, he had murdered someone else. So for him to pay retribution for that, he had to go through stomach cancer.
Yeah, of course, they're not random points where karma emerges. It always traces back to something earlier.
And he didn't have to take the body. But this was a way that he could get rid of this balance, this karma. I mean, I don't know if taking someone's life, but then who knows if there was other karma. And this is why it's really complex. This is a really simplified version of what's going on in this space. But what's really cool about this is that he describes in this vision that once they've formed this body and they've created the plan for everything that's supposed to take place in this etheric body, they then miniaturize it. They shrink it all the way down. They make it extremely tiny. So it's still a little tiny human being, a full-grown adult. They then take it and then they have to go and choose how they get it into the ovum. So what this guide does is the guide goes in with the injection of sperm that is traveling at from their perspective, an extremely fast rate of speed.
Yeah.
But for us, apparently it's 3 millimeters a second or something. But they go down, they chase the sperm. And as they chase the sperm...
Is he in like a little submarine contraption?
I'm not... Well,
and he's homing in on the sperm?
It's not said that, but I'm imagining that's exactly what's going on.
Is it like Top Gun, except they're microscopic?
So he chases down the sperm and he has to pick the one that will allow for this particular body to fit into it. And so it chooses the sperm. Once it finds the sperm, it starts shooting off all the other ones to get rid of them, and then grabs hold of the sperm and then fires it into the ovum. Like, it forces it
right
into the ovum to get it to start coming together. Now, once this sperm goes into the ovum, guided by this jizz guide, it starts
lighting
up. I can see
now why you're calling it the jizz guide.
Yeah, it starts, the ovum apparently starts glowing.
Yeah.
And where it starts glowing is the third eye. It's the point where in the top of the head, in that little body, it starts glowing. And what that is, that's a beacon on the astral plane to where the soul can come in and occupy that body. So what it does then is apparently the little robot thing, little robot submarine, continues by engaging.
If it's a beacon, but you're saying it's already been set up for this individual. So how is it a beacon just for that individual?
Just for that individual. It's just, although in saying that, you know, but this is what it was saying, but I wonder when we talk about soul walk-ins and that kind of stuff, and that is something that's discussed earlier in the book that I didn't get a chance to go into, there is a possibility that maybe it could be hijacked, but that wasn't the point of this story.
Because remember Ingo Swann was saying, it's just, you're in a body,
it's
just random.
Earlier that was addressed, and that was because in some circumstances, some people do just simply fall back into a body.
Yeah.
Like they just go back into a body. They have no, it's like they haven't reached a level of spiritual evolution that they understand.
That's what Swann says. He says, if you're on kind of a higher level, then it can be planned and orchestrated and all set out.
Yeah.
So that you're essentially choosing your next incarnation and all of its, you know,
that's
plan,
exactly
like what
you're
describing.
Said. Yeah. So you can choose, apparently, if you're a higher level, you can choose which parents you want and where you want to come back. And you actually choose your own adventure. You choose, you know, what adversity you want to have and those sorts of things. But you're right. Lower levels just kind of fall back in. It's all kind of pre-planned until a point that they can make that choice. It's
you
all
might come
part
back
of,
as a fog.
Yeah, potentially, exactly. So once then that this robot guide has then sorted out the chromosomes and
it's
everything.
It's a robot now.
Well, it's like, I'm thinking it's
a little submarine with alarms.
And a little submarine with a little arms. I'm just thinking it's robotic for some reason. But it's like pulling
like
the chromosomes
James
apart.
James Cameron in the
looking
for the Titanic.
Yeah, it's just pulling things apart. So it pulls them up and it sorts out, because of cell division, you know how the chromosomes line up and then the little micro tendrils come out and pull it apart. So it handles all that and watches, and it gets cell division under the way. It knows that the body's there and it takes off. It goes off and does its thing. And then obviously the process of birth starts, like actual birth, and the body is born and the soul has to follow through with its lifetime of karmic experience.
Why isn't this in textbooks? It makes so much more sense.
Yeah, biology 101. Really simple.
So if there's a man and he's in a little submarine and we call him a jizz guide. Now, there'll be a test about this on Tuesday.
It'd be all like, instead of naming the organelles of the cell, it'd be like, name all the apparatuses of the weird submarine.
Yeah.
I'm sure that will go down very well. So I found that to be, you know, particularly fascinating. But there was another story in here that got my attention. And, you know, I mean, there's so much more about that particular spiritual movement that I think we need to look into in more detail. And you're right, we did do that cow book.
Yeah, he's got the flying cow, which I covered years and years and years ago. But that's essentially
it was one
Guy Playfair going into just the full mix of the psychics he ran into in Brazil.
Yeah.
The guys that would channel dead authors and write all those novels.
Yeah,
can't remember his name. And channel dead painters.
Yeah, it's just amazing what these guys could do. And like, there are so many stories of that as well where it was actually validated. This is the great part, and this is why his work was really fascinating with these guys, is that whenever they had someone come through, whether it was art or literature, they also had knowledge that only the family would know about that person, and they were able to validate it. So there was something that seemingly genuine was coming through, unless it was some type of entity playing a game.
And their education levels never matched what their output was when they claimed that they were channeling dead novelists and dead authors. Like if they actually sat down and wrote their own story, it would be like, I want to have a chicken and a cow.
Pretty much. Even I was reading about one guy today, and I can't recall his name, but he didn't get past, I think he did 3 months, 4 months of education.
Yeah.
And
that's it.
And then he was writing like Tolstoy. It was it just truly, truly amazing stuff. And that was the same as the art, you know, like abilities that they shouldn't, you know, don't seem to be able to have the skills for. And yet somehow they're producing just, you know, beautiful works. So there was one other thing that I wanted to mention from this book, and it describes a case that was kind of similar to the story I was saying about those weird, I guess, lives of the egos of the previous lives that come up. But it relates to a Kansas doctor, and this Kansas doctor is named Dr. Wiltsey. This Dr. Wiltsy in 1889 was suffering from, I think it was typhus. No, it was typhoid, I'm sorry, typhoid fever. And as he was suffering from typhoid fever, he knew that his end was coming. You know, and it was like, this is the thing. People are like, oh, no, wear a mask. Like, we're worried about coronavirus now. Like, you could
99% walk out, survival rate.
Yeah, you would be dead from typhus or typhoid or scarlet fever or in moments back then. Like, back in the early 1900s, late 1800s, like, you just got on with your life. So this doctor was kind of like this. Like, he caught typhoid and he's like, well, I'm dead. I'm not going to make it. And he was lying in bed. And to make sure that he was actually going to make things easier for the undertakers, he laid in that position of being like in a coffin. So he put his legs out straight and he put his hands across his chest and he was just like interlinked his fingers and he was lying there waiting for death to
just
come.
Just making it easy. Making doesn't want to be an inconvenience to anyone.
Yeah, exactly. So he's waiting for death to come and he's lying there and he's waiting and his sister and his wife are in the room and all of a sudden he's like, oh, this is it. And just lets out this one last breath and he's gone. Except he's not gone. He's clinically dead for 4 hours. But what happens is another doctor comes in and starts examining him and declares him dead. And right as he declares him dead, you get this little and he does this for 4 hours, every few minutes, like this tiny, almost like it was just keeping the body in this state of suspended animation.
Or just a single breath.
Just a single little
what?
And he wouldn't breathe for minutes. And then and like not even, it was like a
corpse
hiccup.
Has the hiccups.
Yeah, it was strange. So obviously they weren't going to go and put him in a sealed container or anything like a coffin. They just left him on the bed to see what would happen for his last breath to finally happen. But what he finds is that he's sitting on the edge of the bed. Like he's sitting up on the edge of bed. So typical of what you hear of so many near-death experiences that people have and the out-of-body experience. But he's sitting up in the bed and he's looking around and he realizes that there are two women and a man in his room. But he doesn't recognize them. He doesn't know who they are. Like, but it's his wife and his sister and the doctor. But for him, it's just nothing. It's almost like this idea of the forgetfulness of death. It's like once a spirit passes into that realm, you forget that information because it's just not relevant. It's just something that you're not supposed to retain. No,
that's usually when you incarnate, not when you've just died.
Well, sometimes it happens in this side as well. And I'm not too sure why. But he claims that once he found himself out, because he felt like no connection to these people, he decided to wander. He decided to go. And so he did. So he goes wandering and he wanders out into the street and he finds that all of a sudden he can expand and contract and move into different realities. And it was just an incredible experience for him. Just truly loving, having this infinite wisdom and knowledge and then yet not recognizing his own family members. But he finds as just as he's about to step over into this other space, wherever this is, he kind of feels this twing, like looks behind him and there's this spider's web-like cord that's running from his body that all of a sudden has gone taut. Like it's something, and he can't see it. It doesn't know where it is. So he turns around and he grabs hold of it. Now you hear of the golden thread or the silver thread in some out-of-body and near-death experiences that people have. But for him, it was really different because when he was dying, he said the way that he knew that he was dead was that all of the anchors in his body suddenly snapped. He said he could feel this wave of all the anchors of every single cell in his body literally snapping and then rolling up like it was high tension steel that had been suddenly cut. And he said everything starts kind of rolling and it all rolled up into a pink ball in his head.
Yeah.
And once he was in his head, he then climbed out of his head. And when he climbed out of his head, he was this naked blue form.
Huh.
And what
I'm agreeing with you because I've recently been reading about ayahuasca and DMT experiences.
Yeah.
More ayahuasca, but where they the individual figures out some kind of huge attachment they have and they hear and feel something disconnect, like a snap from their body. And it's that attachment, it's that anchor, that web being disconnected. And it's a real physical thing in another dimension.
And that's something that the spiritualist from Brazil described as well, is that when that cord snaps, and that would make sense as well, but when that cord snaps, that's it. You can't come back to your body. And apparently there's like an audible warning that's given to you before you go to snap that cord. Apparently it's like, if you go now, and I'm assuming obviously that's in circumstances where you've got the opportunity to return. I mean, if you've been blown up, it's probably unlikely that you're going to have that. You just, you know, instantly cut. But the people hear this audible warning. If you break that thread, you're not coming back. So
what kind of warning is it?
But it's never. It's just like a
submarine warning.
Yeah, no, it's just like someone saying something and they don't know where it comes from. It's just an actual audible warning that comes into their ears. But he said that when he came kind of just, it was poured out of his head, he said. And when he was poured out of his head and he was looking at his wife and his sister and this doctor, he said he was naked. And even though he couldn't recognize them, this is the other thing about things that you, weird things that you take with you. He's like, oh my God, I'm naked. And he thinks some clothes, and some clothes just suddenly appear in his body. But going back into him wandering about and this cord being all taut, what he does is he grabs hold of the cord and he starts pulling on the cord because he's not going back. He's like, I'm not going back. It's just, I'm done. Like, this is great. I'm out of my body. This is brilliant. As he's pulling on the cord, it's almost like there is some type of entity whose responsibility it is to regulate when people cut the cord and when they return to their bodies, because he was insistent on not going back. So he says he was pursued by none other than a cloudy fog.
Oh.
This black smoke cloud suddenly started appeared. It kind of came around a corner and started chasing after him. Now, he knew that this wasn't good. He's had this innate fear to this thing. So he starts running, even though he's got this cord and dragging the cord with him and, you know, knocking people over in the street, I should imagine, as he runs with this cord. And the smoke engulfs him and tells him, whether you like it or not, you're going back. And he wakes up back in his body. So this smoke had somehow like teleported him back.
Looks at his wife and he's like, damn it.
Yeah, he kind of does. And apparently he comes back, he says, to extreme disappointment. I'm like, well, you're looking at your wife? It's pretty horrible. But he was just disappointed that he was back in this reality because he still hadn't completed the, and this is obviously the theme of the book, he hadn't completed the karma. Like, he hadn't completed what he had had to do. And he even had to go through, it seems, this illness, even though it was a terrible illness. He had to go through it to tick some of these boxes that he had chosen, he had agreed to before he comes through. And look, you know, as much as it's terrible when someone suffers from a disability, but there was a really interesting concept that was put forward in this book. And it's a really hard thing to grasp. So I'm not being mean by any means, but when I read it, I thought this is fascinating. So there was one guy that was describing, and apparently this guy was a revered Tibetan mystic. And he had one of the best grips on reincarnation and karma and the whole point of everything. And apparently had some guy come to him who had been deaf from birth. And I don't know how he relayed this to him. It must have been through either writing it down or sign language. But he's really angry. And he's like, why? Why am I deaf? He's like, you're deaf because you didn't listen to people who needed you in your previous existence. And he actually accepted this, and it actually allowed him to come to terms. You know, it's horrible. It's so terrible for someone to go through that. But from a karmic perspective, I kind of get it. I mean, it's still cruel. I guess it's the cruel nature sometimes of the universe. But I thought, oh, that's a really fascinating way of looking at things.
That's the point, is it's not cruel. It's fair.
Maybe, yeah.
It's a fair system.
Yeah, maybe. It's
I don't find it cruel at all. I just think, yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, no, I do. I mean, I feel sorry for someone going through a disability, because if it's not real, I mean, how horrible is that? But I like the idea of reincarnation. I like the idea of karma. And I think
the thing is, once you understand that idea, then it kind of pulls you out of this thinking that all suffering is some kind of evil that needs to be stopped.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Because suffering is not just this evil. It's just not. I mean, sometimes suffering is necessary. Sometimes suffering leads you to something greater.
Well, if you're a Buddhist, you understand that life is suffering.
Exactly.
You know, like, existence is suffering. But you're absolutely right, because the other thing that this Tibetan mystic pointed out was that, look, even though you have these things that come to you, and this is why the story was so good, is that you basically, if you overcome these things, the rewards are immense. And this is the whole point. It's like, if you can overcome these things, like all these earthly things that we think are really important, and I was saying, it was, none of it means anything if you're able to overcome it, and you're rewarded in greater karma later on.
It's like those old Buddhist and Taoist stories, like Milarepa, for example,
his early masters,
that would put him through hell, because they could tell, like, the story of Milarepa, how he had to build a stone house and then take it down and then build it somewhere else. And his master's like, no, I didn't ask you to put it there. I asked you to put it over there. And he had to tear it down and build a stone house. And he did this like 20 times. It's because the master could see in another dimension that he had all this karma he had to get rid of before he could even start teaching him.
Yeah.
So that was the idea. He had to suffer. He had to suffer. So it's harsh, but in the end, it's for his own good.
Well, it appears harsh in our very, you know, if you look at a singular life and you don't, from a very materialistic perspective,
right,
you don't expand out into the spiritual, absolutely it's horrible. But when you understand more of these underlying concepts, then it's like, oh, it's actually not so bad. It's almost a release. Like there was one story which really upset me, but I thought it was intriguing. It related to a Brazilian family, and this Brazilian family was very well off. And they had this child, but from the moment the child was born, the mother despised it. Like she didn't want anything to do with this little boy. And, you know, and having kids, you know, that breaks your heart when you hear a story like that. But the karma behind it was really fascinating. It was because this child that she had murdered her in a previous existence. And so what had happened was, so this mother, I mean, it sounds, I guess, from a materialist perspective that she's suffering from postnatal depression. That's what it sounds like. But from the spiritual perspective, this woman apparently decided, because she hated this child so much and she was so wealthy, they built a separate room or a separate apartments in the home and hired a nanny just to raise this child. And the child got to six or so. And the child apparently was recalling memories from a previous life and kept on kind of asking to interact with the mother. And ultimately the mother got introduced to these spiritualists, and the spiritualists were able to tell her exactly what had taken place. And somehow she pulled that knowledge out as well. And they were able to reform and apparently have a wonderful relationship now. And the bond was really good, but it was this like previous life karma. But what was interesting is that apparently both the child and the mother had made this agreement in the other existence before they came through for him to somehow make amends for the death and the karma.
Yeah, so I love that idea that the relationships in your current life also have karmic ties that are being resolved with every single person that you know.
Yeah.
Or have we would have some kind of tie that we're resolving by working together.
For decades.
Like some kind of horrible thing we did in the previous life. We're paying the penance now with each other's company.
Right. Yeah, that sounds about right. That's fantastic. Yeah.
But there was a great experience I read about months and months ago, and it was from someone who unlocked, they claim they unlocked their ability to see their past lives. And they started going back to, you know, past the 1900s. And there was a point where they were homeless for like five lifetimes. Like they just had this horrible, you know, they were always destitute and poor and could never do anything with their life and just, you know, ended up mentally ill and living on the street. And they thought, that's weird. I wonder where that came from. So they started investigating earlier, and they got to this point where the homeless lives ran out and they started remembering lives as a rabbit and being slaughtered as a rabbit.
Oh.
And there was a bunch of these where they were just animals, like really low kind of tier, to use that term, low tier animals that were basically prey and would just get slaughtered very early in each lifetime. And there was a bunch of these, there's like dozens of these. And then they finally went all the way back through those. And then they finally reached one where it's like, boom. And there was some soldier during a Chinese warring states era, like 3000 years ago or something insane, where they just slaughtered citizens in a war. Like they just slaughtered innocent people.
And he was doing that.
Yeah. And there's a woman in this life, but she saw herself as this soldier just killing innocent people. So that was how to resolve that karma, is all these lives are just being slaughtered as, you know, rabbits, and then this homeless person living this horrible life, multiple lives, there's dozens of those. And then finally they're like reincarnating back as, you know, someone with a better existence.
I think in some way it offers some real comfort as well when terrible things or bad things take place in your life, because it's almost like, well, on a positive level, I'm clearing something.
Yeah.
Like if you believe in that concept, then obviously I'm doing something. And so the other thing I was reading, which is why I was saying it was cruel, is because there's some concepts in here that are, you know, obviously it's free choice, but you shouldn't try and, you know, overly help people, all that kind of stuff, because everything that they're going through because of their karma. And if you interfere, but I'm like,
you still got to have compassion.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's what I find. Yeah,
you can't just live.
You can't go all to spiritualism and
you can't just take this macro view of everything, obviously.
Exactly. Like
if someone's comes out of a burning building on fire, you're not going to go, sorry, that's just your karma. And you don't douse them out. Like, that's pretty hardcore, dude. I'm a Buddhist. I don't believe in saving you.
Well, no, see, where, and this is what I really like about this idea as well, is that, well, you know, if you are following these principles and you shouldn't interfere, the counter argument to that was, no, when you come across these people, because if it's all planned, when you might have a karmic relationship with them.
Yeah.
So by to use a really, I guess, really simple concept, you see someone on the street, you know, begging, and you put a couple of bucks into their cup. That was all kind of meant to happen. And it was almost like a little bit of a test for you as well to show some compassion.
It gives you a chance to show compassion and charity.
I do like the whole someone coming out of a building on fire. Look, I might piss on you. Does that solve the problem?
Or even if you see a homeless person, just rub it in their face. What did you do in a past life, you loser?
Set fire to a $100 bill in front of them.
Yeah. But then a simpler idea could be if you see a fight, for example, like if two people you know are in a fight or if you see a fight on the street, for example, naturally we think stepping in is a good deed. Like stop fighting. But it might be the wrong thing to do because there might be...
That's the concept that I was talking about.
Yeah, there might be all these things that have been, you know, strings pulled and people put into place for these two people to meet at this precise moment and resolve with violence their karmic issue. And you step in and go, no, separate, guys. But, I mean, we know that seems to be a virtuous thing, but... Again, like the human world is this massive illusion.
Complex.
Like we don't know what's behind things. We don't know the true nature of things. So you might be doing a good deed. Like you might be stopping them creating some karmic thing that starts off generations of them hating each other. But maybe you're not. Like maybe you're getting in the way of them finally resolving it.
Do you know what the funny thing about it is? I think that's a really good example because one thing that I've heard about this idea about intervening and how, because it is a fine balance, like you've got to show compassion, but at the same time, you don't want to affect their karmic, you know, what retribution or whatever it is, or their debt that they have to pay. But essentially the idea is that if you step in and help someone, it's actually got to be completely virtuous. And what that means is that if you go and help someone or you donate to something or you do something, this is why Twitter is a really, you know, like a really horrible example. You don't tell anyone. You don't go and do it for the glory from others.
Yeah, right.
You do it just out of the altruistic purpose of doing it, like trying to assist or trying to do something. If you do it because like, oh, I'm going to stop a fight today. That's going to be my good deed. And like, if you expect good karma, it's actually, that's where it's like not the right thing to do. That's where you kind of find that balance. That's apparently how you can determine whether or not it's the right thing to do. But it's just so complex. It's such a complex, difficult thing. And as a human being, we're not meant to understand. And this is why we live so many lifetimes, because you just can't solve it in 100, 1,000 lifetimes. You just got to keep on going through it and through it and through it and through it until you finally get there. But when that is...
I'm pretty sure we're going to solve it this time around, you and I. I'm pretty sure this is it.
Yeah? No. No, I don't see that. I just don't see that.
How many more decades of working together? Like, what are we going to do in 2050 when we reincarnate?
What are you talking about? We've discussed the idea that eventually whenever you stop, we're just going to do another show. We'll just do something else. We're just stuck. We're stuck in this weird show karma.
It's just a karmic loop podcasting for 1,000 years.
So look, I'll link to that book in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org so you can check it out. You know the deal. But also I'll link to some of these Eastern philosophy concepts as well, which are pretty fascinating. And some of those old Chinese folk stories that, you know, give concepts of this stuff as well.
Yeah, cool. Well, let me just quickly mention some of this fairy senses stuff from Simon Young. I'll link to the website in the show notes. And they have a new one running. So if you've had an experience, you can go over there at fairyist.com/survey and fill it out. And I think they're trying to put a new one out.
Is that
either this year or next year?
Where you got, though, that terrible fairy story you told me this afternoon about, I thought fairies didn't exist until I saw something.
What are you talking about?
You were saying that there was some woman that said that there was always a fairy that she thought was in her backyard and she didn't believe it until she walked out and she photographed it. And then that was the end of the story.
Oh, that's the Canadian account. I'll get to the Canadian account.
Oh, you've got that? Okay.
Some of them are terrible. But there's one from the 1980s in Scotland. She said, within a week previous to seeing this fairy, and this kind of follows on from our Halloween show last week, she said, previous to seeing the fairy, I had taken part in a Ouija board session, which was not shut down properly.
Bad news.
So they just left the planchette and run away screaming. Again, she was under the age of 10 when she had this. And a few weeks after this kind of creepy Ouija board session where her friends said they saw something behind her shoulder, but she didn't believe them. They all got scared and just stopped. She woke up one night and felt someone else was in the room. And she looks sitting at the bottom of her bed and this little man about the size of a baby just sitting on the end of the bed. But he looked about 60 years old. Now, she described him. She said he was really skinny. He had features, but obviously wasn't human. And he was grinning and had these sharp pointed black shelled teeth. He had chiseled featured and a kind of ruddy complexion, like olive-coloured skin. And she said what was memorable about him was his pointed ears and he had this dirty, furrowed forehead. Now, eventually he started moving towards her. And she said it's weird because he didn't walk, like jump off the bed and walk up to her. He started floating towards her, started grinning and pointing a finger at her. And she remembers he had this weird pointed nail and it was all black, not from dirt, but painted black. She just remembers all these little details. He kind of pointed at her, grinned, and then disappeared into her bedside table. Just went into the wood and was gone.
Was it like a spirit of the wood in the table or something?
Well, she says, I'm unsure whether my experience with the Ouija board had anything to do with it because I didn't know what a Ouija board was when I did it. So she's 34 years old when she submitted this report, but she said, I am adamant that what I saw was something real. I didn't imagine it. It was real. There's another one I found interesting from Scotland, and there's a bunch of ones I tried to look for that don't directly involve seeing an entity. But they just have this real weirdness to them that falls into the same category of, you know, the fae realm. There's this great one from a woman in the year 2000s. She was kind of mid-40s when she had this experience. And it was a summer evening at dusk. She was with her husband sitting in their garden. And they just bought this place in the garden. It's a little bit like my house. The garden was a jungle. Just an absolute mess. And they were just looking at it thinking, how are we going to clean this up? Like, where are we even going to start?
Fire.
Yeah, well, she just was looking at this mess and she thought she saw something sparkling in the weeds, some kind of weird sparkle. Now, she tried to point this out to her husband, but for some reason he couldn't see it. But she said within the next few minutes, what had been a tangled mess of weeds, it suddenly slowly kind of morphed into this beautifully manicured, landscaped, perfect garden, like perfect plants, and the lawn was fresh and green and everything was trimmed and beautiful and shining. She says the whole thing was glowing and she thought she was having a stroke or something. She thought she was going crazy until her husband said, what the hell's going on with the garden? Look.
Green thumb.
And then because he obviously saw it as well. He turns to her and then he starts flipping out. He's like, look at your face. Look at your face. And he goes up and he's holding his wife's face with his hands going, look at your face, like shaking her. She's like, what? What's going on? And he says, you look like a teenager. You look like a teenager.
Oh.
So she immediately runs inside the house to get a mirror to have a look at her face. And when she looks in the mirror, she just looks like she's her normal, you know, late 40s self. She doesn't see any different. So she goes outside to see him and now the garden's gone back to normal. And he's standing there and he says, as soon as you ran away and went inside, the effect changed and you went back to your normal self and the garden changed as well. So it was this weird, the way it links to the fairy idea was this idea of being glamoured by the fae folk. So it's like they were both standing there and they had this weird glamour come over them where there was this illusion of the garden being beautiful and magical and they had been transformed into these the youthful people they once were.
Why do the fae folk do that? Is that mentioned in the literature?
Well, it's kind of the lure of the other realm.
Yeah.
You know, you go into the other realm and everything's beautiful and magical and you're young.
And you're young, yeah.
Sprightly. But there was a funny kind of link to local lore with this story because all around their garden of this house they'd bought, there were all these old stones built into short walls, kind of like the retaining walls of their garden. And years later, she found out where the stones had actually come from. Where she lives, it's close to what was once a grand estate. And in this public woodland or glen that was nearby, there's next to this old ruined castle, there was this stone-built well, but it was called a fairy well. And apparently for hundreds of years, locals would go and, you know, throw coins in this well and
an offering
to the fairies and wish for something and take the water out and the water would be healing. But there was a landslide only a couple of decades ago. And in the 1960s, people helped themselves to those stones from this fairy well. And all the stones in her garden were from this fairy well.
Oh.
So it's this weird kind of connection.
See, normally when you hear stories like that, if you've disturbed a location that is respected for the fairies, it turns bad for whoever has done it. So she's actually lucky that she had a positive outcome as opposed to a negative outcome, unless they went after the person that made the garden.
Well, there's no follow-up to that story, but it's just good that there's these weird experiences that don't necessarily have a Tinkerbell aspect
yeah.
where you see some no little thing with wings. And then these amazing ones from Canada, this one from Ontario, a woman in her late 50s in the 2010s. She said, "My daughter and I sensed fey energy in our garden by the river, but never knew for sure until we noticed a photo taken at night, which clearly shows a sparkling fairy."
That's it?
Good job, Canada. Good job, Canada. You've let us down. Every other country has great fairy stories. There's not even the photo isn't even included, Canada. Get it together with your fairy stories.
The place is too cold. People aren't outside anyway for the most part.
No, there actually was some interesting ones from Canada. There was a funny one with this guy had moved into this new apartment with his girlfriend and they had combined their pantries together and he had personally...
How do you combine your pantry?
She had stuff from her pantry and he had stuff from his pantry and they moved in together. So it was like a combined pantry.
Right, I see. Okay.
And he was very specific to get chili powder because she didn't have any. So he very specifically went and bought it and he packed the pantry and he very specifically remembers getting the chili powder and putting it in. And a few days later, he's home early. So he's going to cook a chili dish for his girlfriend when she gets home. So he gets everything, he chops the meat and prepares all the vegetables and gets everything ready. And then he goes into the cupboard to get the chili powder precisely where he knows that he put it. And there's no chili powder.
So she's obviously taken it.
Well, now he knows that he put the chili powder in there. There's no reason for it to go anywhere. Like, why would she take the chili powder? That doesn't make sense. So he starts just looking everywhere for the chili powder. And he says in the report, "When I say looking everywhere, I don't just mean, oh, I looked everywhere." He said, "I took out every single item of the pantry and laid it out on the kitchen bench because I knew there was effing chili powder in there. And it wasn't effing in there."
Yeah, it's how people get obsessional about things like that.
And he's just going nuts. He's like tearing the whole house apart looking for this chili powder. So it finally got to the point where he's like, oh, he puts on his shoes and puts his coat on, gets his keys. He's about to go downstairs, drive all the way to the store and get, you know how annoying it is when you're missing one thing and you got to drive all the way and get that one thing. He's so annoyed. But just before he leaves, because he'd been a reader of the 14 Times for years and he knew about the whole fairy, you know, folklore thing of them stealing your keys and little objects like that. So just before he leaves, he kind of, in a joking way, says out loud, "Look, you've had your game, fairies. Please, please just give me back my chili powder." And he actually goes back to the cupboard one last time to check and he opens it up. The chili powder's right there, right in the middle.
Yeah, they like playing games.
And ever since that moment, like he told his girlfriend, when she got home about the issue and they called them the Tex-Mex fairies. Things would go missing in their apartment and they'd always say to the Tex-Mex fairies, "Please, can you give it back?" And then eventually the object would turn up again.
What, does Taco Shelter next?
Yeah, well, there's some funny stories that are like this where little objects go missing. There was another one, I think this one was from Canada as well, where a couple's wedding rings went missing. There was the wife's wedding ring and the husband's wedding ring. And they found the husband's wedding ring. It was at this park and the whole family was there. It was like a family picnic. They found the husband's wedding ring quite quickly, but they just couldn't find his wife's wedding ring. They looked everywhere. They even had metal detectors out and just found everything but the wedding ring until everyone, the whole family had to go home because it was getting dark. And the husband just thought, "Look, I'll just look for another hour and then I'll drive back and meet you all." So just as he's about to give up, similar to the previous story, he remembers the whole idea of, you know, if you've lost something, ask the fairies and they'll give it back. So he just kind of says out loud, he doesn't quite know what to say, but he says, "Look, fairies, you know, if you're listening, I'd really love to get my wife's wedding ring back." And then he doesn't know what to do. He's like, "Give me a sign or something. What do I do?" And just as he thinks this, there's a single crow that's kind of like, like circling ahead. And he thinks, "All right, if this is really a sign, I'm going to dig or look exactly under where that crow is." And the crow flies off. He walks over. And you know how this story's going to go. He digs into the dirt with his knife. And about an inch down is his wife's wedding ring.
That's unusual.
And he can't figure out first of all, how he just found it, because the metal detector didn't get pinged, and it was, why was it buried? Why was it?
Yeah, why wouldn't it just fall on the sand?
Why was it a couple of inches down? It didn't make sense. There's a bunch of missing time ones from Canada as well. There's a woman who was quite young, under the age of 10 in the year 2000s. She said when her and a friend were with this family barbecue in the fall, there were these large woods behind the house and all the kids were kind of playing in these woods. So she went out with a friend and they were hanging out in these woods. They said they wandered for about 3 minutes and they came across a ring of mushrooms. And, you know, that's typically called the fairy circle, right?
Yeah.
So she knew this. She knew this from talking to her friends about a fairy circle. So she danced around inside it for a few minutes with her friend and you know, nothing happened. And they decided to continue playing. But she said, when we stepped out of the circle, the warm sunset suddenly became pitch black. It was like this instant blackness. And they heard their names being called out from family members. You know, their father and mother yelling out through the woods for them to come back. And they started running towards the voices and their family was like, where the hell have you guys been? You've been gone for over 2 hours. And it even got to the point where they had the dogs try and pick up the scent of the girls because they'd been missing. They had no idea where they were and they just couldn't figure out where this time had gone. So it's almost like they had really, you know, had the whole classic fairy circle missing time experience. And she does remember while they were in these woods, she heard giggling that wasn't from her friend. She wasn't sure what it was.
Yeah, isn't it odd though how it's like this childish laughter that's connected with these things? Because it almost sounds cliche, but so many stories describe the same kind of stuff.
And then we get to the weird ones in the US. There's one from California in the 2010s, sorry. This report's from a male. He was in his mid-40s. He was in a woodland with his girlfriend. They were sitting in a beautiful stream. And they had just eaten a gram of mushrooms. This is one of two reports.
Well.
It's one of two reports in the fairy census that include psychedelics. He does explain that his girlfriend was clairsentient. She had some abilities. She had experiences with, she claims, fairy entities in the past. But they were just sitting there talking about this stuff, like talking about her experiences, and he was kind of open to it. And after maybe 15 minutes of talking about this, he said, you know, they just sat and enjoyed being on mushrooms for another 20 minutes. And then they started to get a bit feely with each other. They started to kiss and to, you know, do a bit of grinding and because they thought they were just alone in the woods. And she suddenly broke apart from him, he said, and pointed a bit to the left and said, look, there's something moving. Now, he looks and he sees what appeared to be a person pop out from between the trees and just jump onto the trail that was nearby. Now,
some weird fairy sex pervert.
He says this person was at least 500 feet away, but he started to move down the path. And the way he was walking was weird. He was doing this kind of rapid walking, sometimes skipping, sometimes jerky movement kind of walk. Like a do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Think Willy Wonka breaking into a sprint and then doing some weird strut, then a roll. It's just like this weird
surreal
character doing this bizarre dancing movement towards them. And he says that the being walked and skipped until he was in front of us on the path. Then he turned and saw us and then walked and skipped off the path over the bridge and was soon standing right beside us. So obviously they were, you know, if they're making out, they're off the path a bit. Now, he appeared to be about 19. It was a man. And he was naked except for a pair of leather Celtic or pagan shorts, like something you would see at a Renaissance fair.
I'm hoping they're less amorous now as well when you've got this weird naked thing showing up.
He's wearing a little loincloth. Now, he also had some kind of leather vest on, but that was it. It was open, like showing his weird chest. His feet were bare. And they said he exuded what they called this vibrant, healthy quality. His body was completely tanned with this natural definition, like he was rippling muscles everywhere. And they're just sitting on the ground, like high on mushrooms, staring at this guy. He appeared to be about 5'7" and weighed about 165 pounds. Now, he says, as I was looking right up at this guy and he's looking down at us, I seem to notice that his ears look really strange. Like his ears had this odd shape to them, like that little point at the end. He had thick, dark, curly hair over the years, but not past his neck. And his eyes were strange, like intensely sparkling. And he had this infectious smile on his face. Now, this guy started to explain that he was lost, that he couldn't find his car, and if they could help him. He's saying, "Riddle me this, can you help me find my car, good people?" Now, he explains, he's like, "Oh, well, there's a path you were just on, and if you keep walking maybe a mile, you'll get to the beach, which is right next to the car park, and that'll lead to your car. Like, it's not that far."
By the way, where did you buy your loincloth?
Well, he basically said, you know, "Thank you." Like, "Thank you. I don't understand how I got lost." And he went to do this kind of weird skipping move to leave, but then he stopped and he looked at them again and said, "May I hang out with you?" And they kind of looked at each other and said, "No, I think we just want to enjoy each other's company for now." And then he kind of looks at him and he does this weird move and he's like, "You don't have a tent by any chance, do you? Maybe we could spend some time in the tent together."
What the hell is this thing?
And he's like, "Then we can all go find my car in the morning." And they're like, "No, I don't think we want to do that." And his girlfriend's like, "No, we definitely don't want to do that." And he eventually took this as a cue to leave. He thanked them both for their help and he says, "Good day to you." And he turns away and does this weird roll and skip over to the bridge. And he starts doing this weird kind of jerking, rolling, skipping walk along the path. But he doesn't keep going on the path that eventually gets you out of the park. Just when he's like a couple of hundred, less than 100 meters away, he stops on a dime and starts frolicking into the forest, like off the path, just into the dense woods. Just doing this weird fucking...
Is it some type of weird sex nature spirit?
It's probably just a guy. Like, it's probably just a dude who's also on drugs.
Yeah, potentially.
Who genuinely can't find his car because he's high. And maybe his rationale is that he'll hang out in the tent with these guys until the drugs
but
wear
what's
off.
What's he wearing? And why is he tanned? And why is he ripped?
Why is he in a loincloth? Why are his eyes so sparkly?
Why does he have pointed ears?
And they're just sitting there. Again, they're high on mushrooms. They don't know what to do. Like, they're just sitting there for a few minutes. And just eventually his girlfriend says, "Did you see how he moved? He had to be a fairy," she said. "There's no way normal people move like that. Only fairies move like that." And eventually the submitter to this story said, "Look, besides his robust, outdoor, healthy energy and tanned and ruddy complexion, we also agreed that he seemed quite handsome. But simultaneously, there was something unsettling and vaguely, repulsively, energetically about the guy." So again, he had this exterior that was alluring, but there was something not quite
right.
So it's
faking, yeah. And we hear this in so many of these reports of these entities, you know, projecting an image of what you want to see, but it's not real.
Do you remember the last segment?
Not that you would really want to see that. But
the last segment where I covered these reports, there was one from somewhere in England, and it was a similar thing where this weird guy was just running through the forest and just stopped on a dime and waved at this husband and wife.
Yeah, I do recall that.
Ran off into the forest.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of these. There's another one from Illinois. There's a woman who's, again, she's same age, like kind of mid-40s. Happened in the year 2000s. She was alone. She had spent the last 4 hours hiking across country, she said, in, she doesn't mention the park, but it's somewhere in Illinois. And she said, "It was right about sundown and I'd found the path leading back to the nature center. The temperature suddenly dropped though, and she said everything I'd been hearing in the woods, the trees, the frogs, the crickets, the hum of the bees and the coyotes, everything just suddenly went silent. Oz effect kicks in." And there's a stand of old oaks, she said, and hawthorn trees on the other side of this gorge that borders the path she was on. And for just a moment, she could see someone watching her. She said, "I originally thought it was my husband because he had long, very pale blonde hair and he was tall and broad-shouldered and pretty attractive. But whoever he was wearing different clothes than my husband had been wearing when we drove out to the preserve. He had a fitted, odd-looking jacket of dark green material, fitted trousers of some light tan-coloured material that might have been leather, and they were tucked into knee-high boots. And this was nothing that my husband would even own. And then he was just gone. Now, she said, I hadn't even blinked. He had been looking at me with no particular expression on his face. And the distance between her and this gorge was like 50 feet, so she could see him clearly. And he didn't step behind a tree. He didn't suddenly drop and roll into the grass. He just popped out of existence. Now, a few seconds later, she said, the creatures in the forest and the noise of the trees all started back up again. And she went back to the nature center and went back to the parking lot. Her husband was waiting for her. And she says she got out of there a lot faster than usual.
So she's had the Oz effect take place. Did she have any missing time?
Nothing like that. She had a sense that it wasn't really a threat, but if she had lingered...
She could have been in danger.
Well, not even that. She just said she might have seen something that was abnormal. And she said she felt it might have been rude. It's interesting, her language. She says it might have been rude to stay a little bit longer. But she also said, I wish I could see him again. He was very beautiful. So again, there's this alluring kind of in between the lines thing about these strange wild men that are appearing in loincloths and leather pants and leather jackets and knee-high boots in the middle of the forest. It's pretty freaking weird. So is it Pan?
Sounds like Pan.
I was reading another book today. I don't have it in front of me here, but I'll see if I can put it in the show notes. But the experiencer was talking about when he was a kid, he used to get this feeling that something was sneaking up to him in the forest. He could hear the footsteps. But later on, years later, he developed some kind of, you know, supersensory abilities. And he claimed he understood that it was Pan. And he's like, well, that's where the word panic comes from. Pan, panic. Because Pan is inducing this kind of...
Does it really?
Panic. I'm not sure. You might want to look that up. But it was the mention of mushrooms that propelled me into some of Neil Rushton's work over at deadbutdreaming.wordpress.com.
It does. Panic comes from the Greek god Pan.
Right. Yeah, makes sense. And you've got to check out, if you have any interest in this fairy stuff, you've got to read Neil Rushton's blog. It's really, really good. He has this academic view where he takes it very seriously, but he also includes plenty of stories, plenty of encounters. And it's really fun to read. And when he was looking at this fairy census from Simon Young, he kind of broke down some of these patterns that emerge in there. And he said, look, often you'll have this feeling of incredulity from the respondents, that the fairy encounters, they always underline, look, I'm not insane. This was not psychosis. I wasn't on any drugs. You know, they say this time and time again in the reports. It's one of these really clear patterns. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't on anything. Like I said, there's only two reports in there where they admit, oh, no, or I was on mushrooms or I was on something else. And they just live very normal lives and often have no interest in any of this stuff at all. They just always thought it was nonsense. Now, again, there are only two reports. There's the psilocybin one that I mentioned with this weird guy in a loincloth showing up. But there was another one from Wales where this woman said she noticed two small creatures walking in a grain of wood on a chest of drawers. And there was a procession that had a female in charge. These entities had long pointed noses. They appeared organic, like beautiful little goblins, and were sort of swirling along in their procession. The largest one turned to look at me, noticed I was looking, and then continued with the procession. The fairies just continued to move along the grain of wood and I stopped paying attention to them. It was a strange experience. They seemed to be different to the rest of the psychedelic experience because they were moving along with deliberate intent and seemed to possess a consciousness of their own. They clearly noticed me, but they were not concerned that I'd spotted them. The memory still vivid in my mind. So this was someone that was on LSD with a bunch of friends. And it's interesting because they say, They were on a trip, like they were seeing the normal crazy stuff you see on a trip, like, you know, weird colors and fractal designs. But then the fairies turned up and his memory is the fairies weren't part of the trip. He just happened to see them.
Yeah.
It's like they weren't generated by the LSD, but he
just granted access to being able to see them.
He just happened to see them. There's a similar case like that from the UK where these two young guys, they're messing around under this bridge at night and they see a fairy ball. Like there's a bunch of 3 foot tall fairies, men and women, and it's like they've dressed up for this ball. Some of them wearing tuxedos. There's like a band playing music. There's two fairies making out in the corner. It's like this weird socialite party. And the fairies notice them looking but don't care. They're just too interested in their party. And these two boys leave because they're terrified of what they've seen.
Well, they probably know that no one's going to believe them.
But it's similar to this one where the procession doesn't even care that they've been seen. They just kind of acknowledge it and keep going. But Rushton says, whatever their true nature, it seems that for the fairies to make contact with humanity, they require our consciousness to become loosened from its usual restraints and to enter a numinous zone. So there's a bunch of great examples of being loosened from the regular constraints of consciousness. There's another one of a 39-year-old woman who actually emailed him in July of 2018. And she explains how she lived in London with her husband and very busy lifestyle. They've got two young daughters and, you know, her husband works really hard. She's busy with the kids, you know, typical kind of city treadmill, go lifestyle.
Rat race, yeah.
But her aunt has this beautiful, you know, half acre block in the countryside with a beautiful, beautiful garden with fruit trees. And it's just this magical escape. And she explains how her husband was on this kind of business getaway. And she thought, I'll take the girls out to my aunt's place in the country. So she describes sitting out on the deck in the afternoon, you know, gazing out at the apple trees. And her language, she's describing that her mind was finally disconnected from the hustle and bustle of London. Like she felt like she'd kind of clicked out of that treadmill and just for the first time in a long time was just gazing out and just relaxing. And she saw two squirrels, racing up on one of the trees. But she noticed that they were moving a bit strangely, like their movements were all dartier than normal. And when they moved into sight, she said, I suddenly jolted. My heart was in my mouth because the two squirrels were actually two small little humans. They moved strangely with jerky movements, but I was convinced that they had human form, but I couldn't quite tell the gender. She said they could have been no taller than 2 feet and seemed dressed in dull brown clothing that sometimes melded into the tree bark. And they seemed to be mucking about, playing a game, but she said, I heard no sounds. It's like all the sound had disappeared. Now she pinches herself, she rubs her eyes, but they're still there. And she could just make out facial features and swears that they were human, but again, they were slightly distorted, like slightly wrong for humans. This lasted about 5 minutes and then they simply vanished. And again, it's like the previous woman saying they just clicked out of existence. They didn't hide behind a tree or anything. They were just gone. And as soon as they went, this agitation just went, whew, like she was suddenly stressed. During the experience, it was like, oh, this is amazing. Yeah. As soon as they had vanished, the regular consciousness clicks back in. And it says, oh God, what the hell did I just see? Oh my God, she's anxious, anxious, anxious. So she goes to talk to her aunt. She's like, have you ever seen anything weird in the garden? Her aunt's like, oh yes, the little people come and go. Don't bother them. Like it's just normal to her. She's like, what are you talking about? The next day she goes out again and she swears that she has the feeling something's watching. And eventually in the evening, she again relaxes with a drink and is looking out into the garden and she reaches this kind of, again, altered state of consciousness where she's fully relaxed. And she sees these misty shapes kind of merge from the tree again and watches them for another 5 minutes before they fade away. But this time when they fade away, they give her a bit of acknowledgement that they know that she's watching them because she hears this little whisper right next to her ear. And it sounds childlike, but she says it sounded ever so real. This perfect little whisper say, we tend to the trees. And then she's like, oh! She jumps out of her lounger and the anxiety's back. She's like, oh God, what the hell's going on? She said, I haven't said a word to my husband about this. He's super practical. He would never believe me. In fact, I'm a very practical person. I'm non-religious. I've never considered the supernatural anything more than delusion. But these experiences were real and very supernatural, she said. And they've totally changed the way she looks at the world. And she said that the questioning she now has about how the world works, it's like, you know, nearly 2 years later since this experience, she says that has never gone away.
Yeah.
She questions everything now because she knows that this thing that shouldn't have existed, that was just a delusion, was clearly there before her eyes. She witnessed it twice.
Well, this is something that was highlighted today in the book that I was reading in the Indefinite Boundary, where I think it was only... it was only a year before Yuri Gagarin went into space, where a leading British, I think it was like the British Royal Society for Astronomy or something, was saying, oh, it's absolute garbage that we'll ever go into space. It's not possible. It's just not going to happen. No. And it was like, it happened a year later. No, it was a month later. I'm sorry. It was a month later.
Yeah, wow.
You know, so to go, like, this is the problem. We get stuck in this, like, science is fantastic and it does so many wonderful things, but there's people that get really dogmatic and just say, oh, it's not possible. And so I think things like this that people experience are actually just like little blips on the radar for the occasional person to wake up.
Well, even within science, you have the replication crisis now.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the hard-nosed scientists are having it kind of forced on them that, oh, maybe things aren't so set in concrete as I once thought.
Yeah.
But again, this idea of breaking out of that usual mode of thinking is what allows you to penetrate this realm where the fairies exist. There's some other stuff on Rushton's blog, which is fantastic. Like, he actually traces this modern idea of fairies that exists in occult circles, you know, that's connected to nature spirits, this idea that they tend to the trees. He traces this all the way back to the 16th century with Philippus Aureolus Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim, a.k.a. Paracelsus, who I think we mentioned on a recent show about something completely unrelated. But he went under this name Paracelsus because his name was so ridiculously long. I think that's the most awesome name I've ever heard. Philippus Aureolus Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim. But
pretentious.
In the 16th century, he wrote about metaphysics. He had this enormous body of work and he wrote about alchemical things, but he basically wrote this huge, you know, treatise on metaphysical nature spirits. And he called them nymphs and sylphs and pygmies and salamanders and gnomes. And essentially, I'll link to this blog in the show notes. I won't go through it now, but Rushton demonstrates how this guy's writing went on to influence the Rosicrucian writings that followed in the 17th century. And then all of that went on to influence the Theosophists and Steiner. And then all of that went on to influence the modern kind of...
yeah, it's all related.
Occult, fairy, nature spirit stuff. It all came from this guy who kind of had these perceptions of it in the 16th century. But the way he wrote about it was really cagey. Because if he said there's these other creatures, he would have been burnt at the stake. So he basically had to say, like, oh, there's these other creatures, but they can't go to heaven and they don't have souls. And he had to throw in all this stuff to kind of say that, you know, they don't belong in God's kingdom.
Yeah.
Because he was dancing with the church. But you can tell, you know, he's just being really cagey with what he wrote. Anyway, I'll link to that. But one thing I did want to mention is this great post from John Hannah that's linked to from Rushton. It's called Aliens, Insectoids, and Elves. Oh my. And John Hannah is well known in the psychonaut community. Mm. Like, he's written over at Arrowhead and he runs this conference series called Mind States. He's written for High Times and the Entheogen Review and, you know, all those places where these stories circulate. But in this long kind of essay he's written, he had a section on personal experiences. And he talks about the topic of psychedelic induced contact. And since 1987, he's had these experiences. And he talks about one of his first encounters with a discarnate entity, he says, after he had a couple of hits of LSD. He was in college in Stratford in the UK, and he happened to run into this friend from San Francisco. And his friend just happened to have some acid with him, or LSD, and his friend just gives him these two gel tabs of LSD. And one night he said he dropped both of these tabs of LSD and went walking with a few of his new friends from the school. Now, he didn't know how these new friends felt about illicit drug use, so he tried to hide the fact that he was on LSD.
How can you hide that?
Well, if it hasn't gone overboard, then I'm sure you can probably maintain equilibrium.
Yeah.
But he said the acid came on, and he was just walking along with his couple of friends, enjoying the walk, enjoying the discussion. And then it came out, he said, that one of the women that was with them in this little group was a practicing Wiccan. And he said, as they were walking, they turned down this old deserted Roman road and the group kind of fell quiet for a moment. He said it was late in the evening and the only sound was the crunching of the autumn leaves under their feet. And he said, as we walked, a wind blew down the road that was releasing more leaves from the trees, and it was kind of whirling them into, I don't know, like a tunnel above their heads. Like you can imagine
a little whirlwind kind of thing.
Yeah, autumn leaves just flying everywhere in the wind. And as this was happening, the Wiccan woman in the group just suddenly started to sing in Gaelic. Now, this is a language he's never heard before, and Gaelic sounds weird already, let alone being high on acid and some Wiccan woman is singing it in the evening. She just starts belting out this Wiccan Gaelic tune.
Is it really happening or is he just imagining it?
Because no, she's just singing.
It's really
she just
happening.
Feels
okay.
like singing. And he says, despite the fact that I couldn't understand the words, the tones of the song were actually beautiful. It was, you know, stunning to listen to. She had a really great voice. But at the first note she sang, he said, some of the leaves that were being blown about in the wind transformed into fairies. Dozens of little fairies, winged little pixies, were now flying through the air above him. Now, he'd never seen anything like this before on acid. Again, it's kind of like one of those earlier reports where it didn't seem like it was part of the acid trip.
Yeah, it's always separate.
It was some kind of real solid thing. He said they appeared quite solid and each seemed to have an independent existence. And they're just playfully darting amongst the other leaves and they're clearly fairies. He said it was truly magical and he was totally transfixed. And all the while, his friend is singing in Gaelic. Now, as she hits the final note of this song, he watches as all the fairies, they just morph back into leaves and they all kind of float down with the wind and he can't see it anymore. Now, again, being the only one of them that was on acid at the time, he said, I presumed that no one else had experienced the profoundly moving vision that I had just seen. And the group was quiet for a moment until someone asked the Wiccan girl the name of the song she had just sung. And she said the name in Gaelic and they're like, well, what does that mean? And she said, oh, it translates to the song to call in the fairies.
Hmm.
He's like, what?
So does she know that she was calling him in or she just did it for?
He doesn't know.
Mm.
I mean, maybe if she was a highly advanced Wiccan, she knew exactly what she's doing. Probably not.
Probably not. No, it's just, yeah.
But again, it's this weird combination of, yeah, he's on acid, but it's not like a normal acid trip. They're very real. And it's like, it's just the acid is the catalyst to something else. It's just jerking his mind out of the railroad tracks into something else.
It's funny how these drugs are sometimes referred to as gateway drugs because that word has, you know, multiple meanings. It's like, it's a gateway to another reality.
Or it's a gateway to sniffing heroin off a whore's ass the next day.
Hours, not the next day.
But then he says a decade later, he's camping with three friends. He's out near Island Lake near Nevada City in California.
Is he sniffing cocaine off their ass?
Yeah, he's in a toilet sniffing cocaine. A couple of us, he said, decided to take heroic doses of psilocybin mushrooms. So just a massive amount. And he chewed down 4 grams, retired to his tent, closed his eyes and just laid down on his air mattress. And he said, as the effects of the shrooms came on, his inner vision kind of opened up and he was no longer inside his tent. He was now in this weird hospital emergency waiting room, but everything was made out of this strange green moss. And he was sitting on a bench in this room. And he's like, what the hell am I doing in this weird mossy hospital? And he had the thought that it was strange because there was no patients coming and going. It was like he was in this ER, but it was really quiet. There was nothing really going on.
Had he overdosed?
Well, he was on a massive amount. I don't know if you can overdose on mushrooms. I don't think you can.
No, I think you can.
But after a time, he said he noticed some kind of off-white football-sized larvae floating 3 or 4 feet off the ground in various spots in this weird room he's in. And he's following one of these with his eyes, and then he stops because he sees this weird-looking insect creature about the size of a Labrador, and it's got its back to him. And he says it kind of looked like a humanoid mosquito. It had a long proboscis that he could partially see because it, you know, it had its back to him. But as he's gazing at its back, this thing turns around and it's like, it's just this weird, makes this weird high-pitched shrieking sound at him.
Ew.
And he says, I got the impression it was sending out some kind of warning alarm in this weird moss hospital.
Like he shouldn't be there.
Yeah. The entity then initiated telepathic communication with me, he said, explaining that it was incredibly surprised that he could see it. And it kind of communicated, this is highly abnormal. This usually doesn't occur. So this weird mosquito creature starts to explain to him that it lives by extracting human thoughts and emotion. It explains that human thoughts are both the currency of its species as well as how sustenance. It gets sustenance and its energy source.
Mm.
And the whole time it's explaining this telepathically, he's looking at this filthy proboscis just dripping fluid. It was just weird. He said, I was given the impression that different types of thoughts and emotions are valued differently in this kind of weird currency that they have. So something with a more intense energy charge, like, you know, hate or fear or love, is valued more. It's like a $100 note compared to a quarter.
Yeah.
Like if you're just like
indifference.
If you're like, meh, that's probably a quarter. But if you're like, fuck you, that's probably $100, right? So he gets a feeling that, the entity explains that it exists in another dimension so that it can feed off human thought and emotions unhindered. It can't be detected.
Mm.
He said, I got the feeling that the relationship wasn't symbiotic. Perhaps these thought drainers, he said, somehow suck life energy from humans along with the mental energy.
Oh, we know that. You know, you hear so many of these stories. It is definitely not symbiotic.
He said it claimed that it was the psychic equivalent of an actual insect that feeds on blood, with regard to the extent of any damage it might do to those on whom it fed. So it's like a nasty little bite you might get.
So what spreads malaria though?
But he said, I had the nagging feeling that it wasn't telling me the truth.
Mm.
He said, maybe these creatures had some other influence on us. Maybe they incite wars or disasters in the human realm. He's just speculating. But he said, the experience left me feeling unsettled for some time afterwards. And indeed, the diversity of beings encountered in this DMT space leads one to think that everyone can't really be describing the same creatures. So this point is kind of underlined multiple times. It's because so many people describe so many different things. Even though there are similarities, you can't just put it all under the umbrella of the DMT machine elves, because the variety is almost uncountable.
Yeah, but if you think about it, right, you think about all the different species that there are on Earth that are actually in existence, right?
Mm.
Like if you're a foreign species that came to Earth, an extraterrestrial species, and you saw all these species, you'd be like, oh my God, there's just so many and they're so different, but they're all real.
Yeah.
Why would it be any different in the astral realm?
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's really underlined that we don't know what we're dealing with. We don't know what we're messing with when we're noodling around with these other entities in multiple dimensions. He says once he took this combination of ketamine and DPT.
Oh, my idiot.
And he says, I witnessed two distinctly different discarnate entities thrust into each other's realms for the first time. So it's like,
was he the bridge?
Him taking the ketamine and the DPT opened these weird portals. And he said they just look like aliens from the Cantina Bar in Star Wars. Like one came through with this weird snout and huge eyes and like a hairy fly head. And this other one came through, was like a weird Gumby man. And they kind of turned up in his trip. And they're like,
yeah,
what the hell are we doing here? Why did you summon us? they were angry at him and they were kind of angry at each other. And he said he watched them as they kind of brokered a deal together.
For what?
He said, one of them passed a small item into the other's hand while mentally shooting me a warning that I had fuck all idea what I was dealing with. And I was left with a strong impression that I should consider myself lucky that they let me off the hook, because the chemical cocktail I had drawn had brought us all together in the first place.
Isn't that strange, though, how, because we hear of ayahuasca with it being sometimes described as mother ayahuasca or a snake form, you know, but taking that different substance, like different types of substances, and bringing forward different beings.
That's what I was thinking too, because, you know, when you take ayahuasca, you're talking to the mother ayahuasca. If you take a boga, you're talking to old man aboga. You're talking to the spirit of the plant or the substance. He's mixing the two. So he's bringing in some alien from the ketamine dimension and some DPT, like Boba Fett monster.
He's actually lucky he didn't die, because ketamine being a relaxant and taking DPT, it could cause a lot of problems.
They have to make some deal to what? Not destroy his mind? I don't understand.
Just looking at what the...
He says he's encountered small insectoids on 2CB, on ayahuasca. He's discovered large insectoids. And yes, when he smoked DMT, he said, I've entered the translinguistic alien dimension populated by McKenna's mischievous mutating machine elves. Now, in this essay, he then talks about the criticism of these encounters. The critics that say, oh, this is all just manifestations of childhood fears, or they're cerebral projections, or it's some Jungian archetype.
It could be in some circumstances, but in other circumstances, I don't understand why people so readily dismiss the possibility that it actually could be a being.
Well, I liked the quote
entity
from two famous Bay Area psychonauts who used to write a lot about their experiences in the late 80s and early 90s. They were known as Gracie and Zarkov. And there's tons of their reports on Erowid.
Well, I'm just looking at Erowid at the moment, just seeing what some of the experiences are, and they're pretty full on.
I've got a bunch of links I can give you for the show notes, but there's this great quote from Zarkov who said, look, you give DMT to 10 people. They've never had DMT before, and you tell them only that they might see something. If 9 out of 10 of them come back with descriptions of elves, and 4 of them use the word elves unprompted, you'd think we should investigate the phenomenon of elves seen on DMT.
Yep, good point.
I agree with them. Again, if you look into the writings of these guys, you find all these kind of gems. Like there's one from Zarkov in 1987 where he talks about taking a bunch of LSD and meeting the goddess for the first time. He said the goddess was the first real contact experience I had had. He said, I've had contact with about half a dozen different entities since then. But what makes this one so impressive was that I wasn't a believer in this type of phenomena on a gut level too. He said, I just didn't accept it. But what I got on this particular contact was very specific advice on how to deal with people in my life.
I thought the advice was to stop taking drugs.
Yeah, what are you doing? But basically he explains he was having a lot of personal difficulty with people that were close to him. He doesn't detail it, but, you know, family members and friends and loved ones. And he was just starting to explore LSD. And he got into this contact with this strange goddess type entity. And it was a really lengthy set of situation specific pieces of advice on how to behave. Like, he went to therapy with this weird creature while on LSD.
But what do you mean how to behave? Did he have...
Well, here's the thing. He couldn't quite understand what was being communicated, because most of the goddess's voice he couldn't understand. He said it was like listening to really fast tape recorder music. She was like it was just rapid. Now, I find that really intriguing, because I've heard it said that because time travels differently in other dimensions. Mm. So if you were to hear a being in another dimension just speak naturally, it would sound all distorted because the time flow is different to our dimension.
Yep.
So it's almost like that's what he's experiencing. But he said it wasn't like a chipmunk sound. Tonally, it was beautiful. But at the end of this contact experience, this goddess entity gave him these golden scrolls, like kind of presented these 6 golden scrolls to him. And then for about 6 months after this LSD trip, whenever he was in a situation, like he was at Thanksgiving dinner or something, and he starts arguing with his dad, or, you know, some kind of conflict comes up, he hears this brief burst of singing in his mind, this kind of, and in his third eye, he sees the scroll unravel. Like you can imagine, just he's just in the middle of this argument with his dad and this scroll unfolds in his mind's eye. And all of a sudden, he now
understands. Don't be a dick. Stop being a loser.
He just gets this advice, but he understands what the sped up tonal language from the goddess was. It suddenly unlocks in his mind. He understands the content of the scrolls and he changes his behavior. You know, he stops being a dick and he stops arguing or whatever. And then this happens time and time again. These scrolls unravel in his mind. And he says all these people and family members started commenting me that I was so much easier to get along with. I was listening to people. I was paying attention to their needs. And, you know, I thought this was really strange because this is all from this goddess entity in this LSD trip. And I couldn't tell anyone because they'd think I'd completely lost it.
How unfortunate, though, that you have to utilize a substance to make contact with a being like that, that can improve your life. And the danger that comes with utilizing those substances, and I don't mean just from a medical standpoint, I mean from engaging with, he's actually probably been very lucky to engage with something that is symbiotic as opposed to something that is going to feed on him.
There's some really great stuff from these guys. It's kind of like a mini golden age of these experiences before everyone had read about them. Because the problem is when everyone reads about them, they've already got this idea in their mind of what the experience is and then it colors it. But these guys were like kind of
cutting edge.
Not super cutting edge, but you know, they were being original with what they were writing and experiencing. I'll link to a bunch of stuff. I did go into this really early one from the 1960s, this scientific study on the effects of the LSD on the human psyche. I'll put that in the show notes as well, mainly because I just skipped to a random page because these guys did a full like Strassman style study where they had subjects and took them to a hospital and administered doses with a doctor and observed them over
submitted doses and knew exactly how much. Yeah.
Observed them over a long period of time. But the first one I clicked to was this subject S6, and it's a woman in her 20s who takes a DMT dose and she's just like, she kind of asks to see God. And God is this giant diamond cat that hates her guts and just meows at her. And it's so hilarious because the cat turns up and it's this all-encompassing demon cat that just completely replaces her existence. It's made of crystal, like silver, and it starts meowing at her, but it's like, meow, meow. And halfway through this experience, she's just screaming like, make it stop, where's the cure? I need the cure. And the doctor's like, you have another 45 minutes to go.
Yeah.
It's only been 3 minutes. I think you should calm down. And she's like, 3 minutes? And meow, meow, meow. It's like demonic meow that keeps going. It's freaking hilarious reading it, because she's just flipping out. And because she went in thinking she was going to meet God.
And what God's a this, stupid assumption,
God's
though.
God's this demonic cat.
God's got time to meet you and your drug trip.
God's this demonic cat that just keeps meowing. And she's like, the meow was this diabolical noise. The chilling thing is that I knew what it was saying. It was telling me that I was a flaccid worm and it was going to crush me. It was horrid. She's like, where's the antidote? But at the end of the experience, she finally learns how to remove herself, because she removes herself from it and then this tentacle thing tries to reel her in and it's going to be this horrible experience. But she eventually learns to take herself out of this kind of lure of these entities.
Like the lesson in it.
And finally it's wearing off, but she has this thought right towards the end. She's like, but I didn't get to see God. I really wanted to see God.
Oh, so you didn't learn anything.
And all of a sudden there's this like, and her perception kind of shrinks. And it's like, you know how you got a toilet paper roll and you look through it as a kid? It's like that, but it's like a huge telescope. It's this really long tunnel. And she's looking through it and there's a face at the end. And she's like, is this God? And all of a sudden there's this whoosh, and it starts zooming into this face. And she's like, oh my God, I'm finally going to see it. I'm going to gaze on the face of God. Oh my God. And it finally zooms in.
The cat.
That's a fucking... It's a capuchin monkey. just grinning at her. The experience is over. It's fucking great. I'll link to that book in the show notes too. Do I have that with me? Yeah, that is. Do I have that? I must have deleted it. Oh, no, there it is. The Varieties of Psychedelic Experience, the classic guide to the effects of LSD on the human psyche.
Oh, we might have to dig into that in more detail. Yeah. That sounds like it's fun.
Robert Masters and Houston Jean. It came out in like 1966 or something.
Right.
It's a really old one. But that's a wrap for this fairy stuff. I might come back to it in a future episode. But again, the kind of consensus is our consciousness locks us in.
Yeah.
To this limited view of the universe.
Absolutely, it does.
And we're just missing out on this menagerie of demon cats, monkey gods, all sorts of weird fairies, and little gnome creatures that sit on the end of your bed at night.
It's probably a good thing, though, in some circumstances. We're probably not meant to see them.
Yeah.
Think about it. Like maybe we're just, it's hard enough to survive in this physical reality as it is. We really don't need to be seeing these beings.
No. Like imagine you're getting dressed in the morning and you turn around, there's just a little 60-year-old man who's 2 feet tall sitting on the end of your bed.
Yeah.
Just masturbating.
Over your underpants or something.
No, yeah, no one wants those powers. No,
you don't want that at all.
That's a wrap for this show. Thank you so much for being on Plus. We'll catch you on Friday for your next MU. See you then.